The foe, Whitehead, writing in the April 1993 edition of the Atlantic Monthly, said, over the past 2.5 decades, Americans have been conducting what is tantamount to a vast natural experiment in family life. Many would argue that the experiment was necessary, worthwhile, and long overdue. The results of the experiment are coming in, and they are clear. Adults have benefited from the changes in family life in important ways, but the same cannot be said for the children. Indeed, this is the first generation in the nation's history to do worse psychologically, socially, and economically than its parents. More poignantly, in survey after survey, the children of broken families confess deep longings for an intact family. What has been this vast natural experiment in family life? It's obvious. It's been the experiment in what do we do with marriage. For the first time in our history, and one of the very few times perhaps in all of history, we have actually experimented with the deepest DNA of our society and our culture, with the very core, the building block of life. In our day, we have made self-satisfaction the highest value rather than self-sacrifice. And it has resulted in the absence of fathers. The fact of the matter is, by putting our own interests ahead of our children's, very often our children have suffered. This is not to say that in every single parent family there has been suffering. This is not to say that in every single parent family there has been harm brought to children. This is to say, statistically, that the patterns tell us that that is more common than not. The evidence tells us certain things. The most obvious of the realities have been overlooked in our grand experiment. There was a statement that I know I've made here, read to you previously, but I can never escape from this statement. This is one of the most amazing statements I have ever read in my life. This is the statement from a credible researcher who has spent years and years and years tracing family patterns, a counselor who has kept careful records, conducted a controlled study, has met every one of the scientific standards necessary in the field of psychology in order to come out with an accurate understanding. Here is what Judith Wallerstein says. Amazing as it may seem, developmental psychology has only recently become aware of the vital role fathers play in the lives of their children. How can this be written in one of the best-selling books in America? How can anybody say, it just blows me away. Obviously, I get worked up over it. For many years, child psychology was preoccupied with the mother-child relationship as if fathers were secondary figures. Isn't that a tragedy? And don't some of you know what I'm talking about? Haven't you wrestled with these very issues in your own life? Take, for example, hereby, I don't know quite how to describe it, but I've been all through the Dallas Morning News this morning. I've not been into the One ads. I don't know whether there's any Father's Day advertisements back in the One ads or not. I have not read every page of the paper, but I've been basically through the front page, the Metropolitan page, the sports page, which on the back of it has several Texas Rangers and their families. So there is some recognition that it's Father's Day. I have been through the Texas and Southwestern segment. I've been through the Sunday Reader, and I've looked at and scanned the business page, at least the front of the business page. The only two references to Father's Day I have found were on the back of the sports page with some neat pictures of Texas Rangers and their children, and on the Sunday Reader, a discussion of Clinton and Gore as fathers. I don't see anything in the headlines. I don't see any articles featuring fathers. Now, I may have missed it, but when you'd think that, I mean, I can read. And you think by scanning through that much of the paper, I would have found something. I didn't find anything that would have suggested to me fathers are the most strategic leaders in our society. And yet we are. What difference do fathers make? You know, you'd think that's a chauvinistic statement. I mean, you know, Lawrence, you're a father. We know you got three kids. You talk about them all the time. I mean, it just gets boring. And you're going to be just like Kugler if you ever get grandkids. You're going to stay. I mean, you're just going to. And why not? Tell me why not. I can't figure out why not. I'm with you 100%. I could not support you more. And I understand. I understand all of those feelings. That's a chauvinistic statement. Just because some sort of biological incident made you a father doesn't really mean you're all that important. All right? Let's listen to the research. In the age of feminism, listen to the research. All the sickness of our society can be traced to the shift away from a focus on fathers and their role in the family and society. All the research in recent years traces every ill in our nation to this reality. Crime. 70% of the people in prison for violent crime today grew up in fatherless homes. Rape. 65% or more of the people in prison today for crimes of violence against women grew up in fatherless homes. Violence. The vast majority of perpetrators of violence in our society today live in and grew up in fatherless homes. Child poverty. Child poverty. Did you see the recent statistics? The increase has been tremendous in the last 15 years. Comes from fatherless homes. Teenage pregnancy. The possibility of teenage pregnancy increases beyond belief when there are fatherless homes. Children from single-parent homes are more likely to commit crimes than those from traditional families. They use drugs more heavily. They are more likely to be gang members. They make up 70% of delinquents in state reform institutions. 76% of adolescent murders. They are 70% more likely to be expelled from school. Those are the statistics. They're not subject to a great deal of interpretation when they're that firm and that big. The greatest crime in America today is the crime of fatherlessness. Here's an interesting question. What reduces crime, child poverty, teenage pregnancy, and reduces no new taxes? You interested in the answer to that? Good fathers. I could go on and on. And by the way, one point I want to make is this. This issue has nothing to do with race. There are no racial connections, except to say that whatever race a father in the family makes a difference in the child. There's no racial correlation of any kind. None. Fact of the matter is, it doesn't even necessarily correlate with good fathering. It's surprising and amazing to discover in the research that even a not-so-good father makes a profound difference in the family. Certainly with the exceptions of any sort of abuse. These realities have everything to do with the failure in fathering that marks our nation today. And in light of these realities, we need to look at fathering. And I want to turn to one simple passage. It's not a difficult passage at all to grasp or to memorize. You actually could memorize it in these few moments that we're going to be looking at it. It's Ephesians chapter 6 at verse 4. It is amazing in its simplicity and even more amazing in its comprehensiveness, in its totality. It's a principle of simplicity and totality that if all of us as fathers will follow as long as we live, we will see a difference in our children. I recognize that my children have the freedom to make choices, and they are making them, and they make them consistently. And I can't control all the choices that a child makes, even in high school. We couldn't control all the choices that our children would make. We could certainly influence them. We could ask them about it. And I've asked my son some deeply personal questions, very personal questions, about what's going on in their lives and in their relationships. Because I feel as a father I should. But even with all of that, I understand that the best of families does not always produce the best of children. I understand that. But patterns and trends enable us to see that good children tend to come from concerned families. You notice I didn't call them all good families. But at least families that care. We struggle. We all struggle. We can't play games. But they're families that care. And this morning I want to ask this question. What are fathers for? What are fathers for? And I'm going to answer it in two ways. One, what fathers are not for, and then what fathers are for. What are fathers not for? Ephesians 6:4 tells us fathers are not for frustration. Ephesians 6:4, and fathers, do not provoke your children to anger. Fathers, do not provoke your children to anger. As fathers, we are commanded not to create anger in our children. How do we create anger in our children? When we provoke them. What does that word mean? It's a very strong word. It's a muscle word. It's an energy word. It's a big weather word. It's a thunderstorm. It's a tornado warning word. Provoke is a word that means to cause, to explode, exasperate, ignite. But what is even more important is, it's not just talking about, say, an occasional situation. It's not just talking about something that happens, but rather what it's talking about is a settled attitude. We can create in our children a settled attitude of frustration and provocation that creates this as their settled basic response to life. We are not to cause a deep-seated rage in our children. Sometimes we wrestle with anger as adults. I know what that is. And very often that grows out of an atmosphere that was generated within us by the family in which we grew up. Now, the key thing is to realize, of course, as adults, we now have a choice. We can stop the chain. We can stop the impact. We can make decisions through the grace of God, His energy and His power. Not easily. These are the decisions themselves we want to make, and they're relatively easy to make. It's the implementation of the decision, and it is not an easy thing to do. But one of the things that fathers must understand is how great our influence is. You see, we create the very inner atmosphere in which our children live. We actually generate the weather that exists in our children. We are the ones who are the source of their feelings about life and wholeness and reality. We can create a sense of peace and purpose, or we create a sense of stress and emptiness. The way we raise our children determines how they feel about the realities of life. The apostle speaks to us for one simple reason. We set the tone in our families. That's from one end of the Bible to the other. That's from one end of the research to the other. Fathers set the tone. Mothers are not excluded. Mothers are not second rate. Mothers are first rate and essential. But somehow, maybe because moms don't tend to pull away from their children. Maybe because moms tend to relate and connect more on the emotional level. But there is something about a father that makes all the difference in the atmosphere of the family. We set the tone for our families, and we must choose to create an atmosphere for growth in our families. You may have been raised by a father who disobeyed this command. You must make a choice to give up the anger that has come, that has been ignited within you. And I'm going to come back to this again because I'm telling you the key in all of this is forgiveness, forgiveness, forgiveness. But if you choose to hang on to it, you're only hastening your death and raising your children to be the same kind of angry people that you may have become. Take responsibility for your anger and call on God to enable you to give it up before you do great harm to your children as well as to yourself. Now the question is this, how do we provoke our children? After all, Paul tells us, Ephesians 6:4, fathers, do not provoke your children to anger. How do we do this? Interesting quote from Victor Hugo, who said, the supreme happiness of life is the conviction that we are loved. The most significant and strategic thing a father can do for his children is to love them. Now the question is, how do we fail to love our children? Or on the other hand, what can we do to love them? Basically, the issues, the primary issues, are issues of rejection or acceptance. We reject our children when we are absent from them. Howard Hendricks has said that the average American father spends 37.7 seconds per week with his children. Or per day, excuse me, per day with his children. 37.7. Now, I don't know how they arrived at that number. That has to be a lot of days when nothing happens. 37.7. The biggest problem that we wrestle with, and I have wrestled with this, the biggest problem that we wrestle with is we're too busy for our children. We have a business breakfast early in the morning. We work late at the office after everyone is gone because, because no one else is going to bother us. The phone won't ring, or at least we have voicemail now. We don't have to answer it. Or we can answer it at our pleasure and get the message when it's convenient for us. On weekends, we have to work around the house, or we're so worn out we don't have energy or patience to be with them. So, you know, you can be absent while present, and sometimes while present, you've been better off being absent. I've had those moments. Maybe you understand what I mean. We are often committed to success, to more and better. We use the name of our children, but that's not always the case. Now, the question is this: must we be failures in business in order to be good fathers? I don't think so. I don't think so. But I am calling for every father in this room, whatever his age, because no matter how old we get, we continue to be fathers. We will be fathers long after we're dead. Age is not the issue. It changes. But I am calling for us to take stock of our commitments and to determine that we will center our lives around the Lord, our families, and our service to Him in business and in the community. But then we must make certain that we are taking weekly and even daily times to make choices, to know and understand our children. I cannot emphasize too much with you the time that you take to know your children. I've told you this story before, the old debate about quality and quantity. Remember that? I saw it on the back page of the sports page today. I don't know which one of the Rangers it was, but one of them said, "I try to put more quality in because I don't have much time, much quantity to give." Sounds great, but I told you about this. The time that Lena, when our children were younger, she didn't like this quality thing. She didn't think much of it. You know, Lena's a very sweet and quiet and consistent, very consistent person. Very consistent. It would surprise, but it would stun you to know that she can be kind of opinionated sometimes. And that she can express these opinions. Like she said to me, she said, I'm not sure about this quality and quantity time thing. I'll tell you what, the next time we have steak, I'm going to buy the best steak I can find. And I'm going to give you a piece this big, and we'll see how that works out. Now, you know, there was a message there. And even I got that message. It takes a while for me to get them, but I got that one. No, she doesn't believe in this quality stuff. You know why? Because she knows what I've learned. Quality requires quantity. You can't know a child if you don't spend time with that child. And not to spend time is to reject that child. National survey taken some years ago says that there are four things that take fathers away from their children: jobs, outside activities, television, and financial pressure. Now, there's one on that list that can go now. Television. Television. Forget it. Television can go. Financial pressure, a little more difficult to deal with. But look, sell the house. Get out of the lease. Cut down on the lifestyle. See, the interesting thing about it is that we are driven by lifestyle. The number of hours we work often relates to the number of dollars we spend on our lifestyle. Isn't that right? You know, you don't have to cap business success. If we cap lifestyle demands. Because there may be ways that we don't have to worry about as many things and have as much emotional distraction. Outside activities can also be limited, can be dropped. One of the things I've learned is that home is not the place where I come to rest. Home is the place where I come to lead. And I've also learned through my wife that if I will come home and make genuine efforts at leading, she is really going to make certain that I rest. Because the last thing she wants when I'm leading is for something to happen to me. I'll tell you something else, though, that can be a distraction to us. Oh, and by the way, if it's possible for you to focus on job success and be a success at home and be a success in walking with God, terrific. Go for it. I love to see believers in positions of influence and capacity where our values are needed there, our presence is needed there, our style is needed there, the atmosphere we generate in a corporate setting in the business world is needed there. Go for it. But if you can't, then the first place the battle must be fought is with the Lord and in the family. There are other things that indicate rejection, not just the removal of ourselves from the presence of our children, but control. Controlling our kids. Talking without listening. Just grunting and running right over their explanations, not giving them an opportunity to express themselves. Just kind of basically, I'm in charge around here, line up and march. Very destructive. Very destructive. We demand sometimes without listening. Our children are right, and we are wrong, or we just have some standards which they must have. I never will forget a 16-year-old boy who came to see me when I was, before we had any children, I was only pastoring a short time. He set the whole tone for all of my fathering philosophy based on the Word of God. Came into my office, he's 16 years old, and he cried and cried and cried because his father would not let him have long hair in the late 70s. In the early 70s, remember around 1970 or 71, because it was a sign of rebellion, and all the other kids had long hair, and he went to school feeling like he was nude. And I made a decision, and you could see it in my kids. Hair will never stand away. I remember one time, our oldest son, decided he wanted sort of chevrons in the side of his hair, you know. His little stripes. He was 2 years ahead of everybody else. And we came to church one Sunday, and one of the women here in the Berean class came up to my wife and said, Lena, I feel so badly. You know, about your son's hair. Because it was just sort of catty. It was cattywampus. I mean, it just was not the thing. He was setting a style. And Lena's response was, oh, I cut it that way. And we all had our moments. There's a basic decision. No kid's hair is going to stand in the way of a father's heart. We can decide without consulting. You know, one of the things we have to remember about our children, they're like young trees planted in the front yard. Did any of you ever plant any trees, move into a house and plant any trees? We planted some trees. And I never will forget, California storm hit, and these trees were young, and they, you know, we had the stakes in place, but man, they were not going to make it. They were going to get blown down. We'd put all of our energy into planting these trees. We'd spend all our tree money. We didn't have any more tree money. Those trees were going to stay up. Here the wind is blowing 40 or 50 miles an hour. It's pouring down rain. It's probably close to midnight, and I'm standing out there hanging onto this tree while it is restaking the thing so we don't lose it. And if you were to go see if it's still, I don't know, people are probably taking it out of the house, but if it's still there, it formed this great sway back as it grew from the wind and the struggle. You know, that's what our kids are like. And fathers, we got to get out there in the 40 and 50 and 100 mile an hour wind and grab a hold of that kid while our wives may be correcting the wires and staking it down so we can hold on to that kid so the storms of life don't blow her or him away. We can't lose our children. We have to give ourselves to our children. Dads, we have to give ourselves to our children. And we also have to let our children be themselves. Here's a prayer for a teenage son I read some years ago. I identify with it. Lord, the night is quiet. There's only the hum of the clock glowing at 3:11 a.m. and the even breathing of my wife and the quickened beating of my heart. For Bill is late, so much later than he said he'd be. You know, he's a good boy, Lord, kind and thoughtful, but oh, so vulnerable. And there are so many pressures out there in the world of the night. Noiselessly, I creep from my restless bed and silently prowl the shadowed rooms. Lord, you have blessed us with him and blessed him with your grace. Listen to my prayer and watch over him now. I wait for the phone to ring and not to ring, for my fear is great. Trust, you seem to tell me. Trust in me and do not fear, but the beat of my heart will not quieten. Now at last I hear his key in the lock and I am filled with the warmth of relief. Thank you, Lord, for bringing Bill safely home. Now help me to listen as he speaks and not to be angry. Fathers are not for frustration. What are fathers for? Let me tell you what fathers are for. Fathers are for freedom. Fathers are for freedom. We exist to give to our sons and daughters a sense of identity, a sense of security, and a sense of confidence in life that releases them to be themselves. That's what we're about. We're about leading our children into the freedom of health, into the freedom of morality, into the freedom of truth, into the freedom of knowing God. We're about teaching our children how to make choices that keep them out of the bondage of evil and the bondage of destruction and the bondage of shame and the bondage of death. That's what we're about. We free our children, as the text goes on to say, fathers, do not provoke your children to anger, but bring them up. To bring them up means to feed them. It's the idea of taking someone from one need to another need. The needs are physical, they're mental, they're emotional, they're spiritual. And by the way, we'll never bring our kids to a point of spiritual commitment if we have not taken care of them physically and emotionally and mentally. They'll never come to spiritual commitment if we don't take care of those other dimensions. This is why we must adjust our lives to meet their needs. Let me tell you, what are some significant steps we can take? I want to give you four specific steps to bring our children up in the Lord. Number one is to pray for our children. Pray for our children. Pray. I cannot begin to tell you what role prayer has played in our family. I have sat in my backyard many days, many times I've gone out to think about my children, sat in the shade of my backyard and written down on a page, what about Kent? What about Joel? What about Kyle? Created a list of needs, created a list of things I see happening. Look down the line 3 months from now, 6 months from now, a year from now, next week, whatever it is. But I've looked at it and I've begun to create out of that a list of prayer, things to pray about. And I want to tell you something. Every time I've done that and I've prayed, I've seen God answer those prayers without a lecture from me. Someone says, how do you raise kids? I got one answer. Pray for them. Pray intelligently for them. Now I have some more. Another thing is to listen, fathers, listen to your wife. Listen to your wife. I don't know how many times Lena has stopped me from doing something unreasonable, harmful, that would have frustrated one of my sons because I didn't understand the son, because I was expecting a particular response, and she would interpret their temperaments and personalities to me. She did spend so much more time with them. She knew them so much better than I did. I learned them through the grid of being with her. I learned them through myself as well. But she helped me so much to give me patience and perspective and insight and not to act when I was ready to act, and I would have harmed the child. Third thing is, we must let our children know us. We must let our children know us. I come back to a decision that we made at the beginning of the senior year of every high school year of every one of our children. I sat down and I said, we're changing the relationship. I'm going to let you know more about me. I'm going to tell you more about me. I'm going to tell you more about my life. What is happening on my job? What am I afraid of? What am I concerned about? I'm going to bring you into my life. I want you to know me as a man. I wanted my sons to know that men have fear. I wanted my sons to know that men wrestle with their jobs. I wanted my sons to know that men have concerns. They weren't old enough to know it, but by their senior year in high school, they should be. And they need to. And they need to know it before they go away to college. Pray. Listen to our wives. Let our children know them, know us. And my last one is spend time to watch, observe, listen, talk, think, pray, act. Spend time. Now the text tells us that there's two more things we need to do. We need to bring them up in the discipline and instruction of the Lord. What does it mean to discipline? It means to educate them. But it's interesting because the focus on this word is on physical discipline. It does involve us in physical discipline. It says that we need to be engaged and we need to be willing to use with wisdom and carefulness physical discipline. I don't like doing it. I found that any kind of discipline of my children meant discipline for me. Where my children lack discipline, I believe it's because I didn't discipline them. I didn't have the discipline to do it right. Faithful discipline demands personal discipline. I would suggest it also demands preventive discipline. There were many times I did not have to discipline my children because I did one other thing. I played with them. Play with your kids. You won't have to discipline them as much. One thing I will tell you is this, where I did have to discipline our children, there was always a pattern to the discipline. The child had to acknowledge he did wrong. He had to agree that he had to say what he did wrong, so I knew he understood why he was being disciplined. I did wrong. This is what I did. There was the discipline, and then at the end of every discipline event, there was a taking of the child and a statement, I love you. And we never parted until that was done. Never leave a child angry. Always leave a child in your arms with a kiss. When they got too old for physical discipline, then there came other forms of discipline. But always, always communicate love. The other factor, as the text tells us, Ephesians 6:4, is not only to bring them up in the discipline, but also in the instruction of the Lord. The greatest source of instruction, my friends, the greatest source of instruction is your model. Your model. Don't ever try this. Don't listen. Don't do what I do. Do what I say. Don't try that. Your model. Fathers, model what God wants done. You say, that's a big job. No, that's not a big job. That's not a big job. That's a supernatural job. There's no job bigger. Only God can enable you to do this. Fathers are for freedom, not for frustration. But if you had a father who turned out to be for frustration and not freedom, fall on your face and plead with God to enable you to forgive him. Forgive him. Forgive him. What if you as a father realized, I have been frustrating to my children. I have done things. I haven't given them myself. I haven't given them my energy. I haven't given them my time. I haven't listened to them. My kids are always saying to me, you don't listen to me. By the way, when a child says that, you know what to do, don't you? So stop. Say, tell me again. Then repeat it back to the child so the child knows you listen. Doesn't change a thing. You're still, unless you were wrong. Now, if you were wrong, you better say so. But if you were right, keep right on doing what you were going to do. But now the child knows, yes, you did listen. But if you're that kind of father, I want you to do something right now. Leave here today, and the first thing you do, before you eat a meal, before you do anything else, You find your child, you get on the telephone, you write a letter, you send a fax, you email, but you do something about, if you have been a frustrating father, you do something about it. You confess that sin. You acknowledge it. Some of you may have been divorced and you're now been removed from your children for 5, 6, 7 years. Christopher Darden, the L.A. former district attorney, was on TV this morning. I caught just a few minutes, acknowledging that when he moved from Oakland to Los Angeles, he lost contact with his daughter the way he wanted to have it. He said it was wrong. I love to hear it when people will say that. I want to say to you, if you've done that and you're out of touch with your children, I want to tell you that your kids act like they don't want anything to do with you, don't they? Tell you why they act like that. Because they've told me, not your kids, but other kids, adult children like that. You know what they've told me? They've done it because they don't think you want anything to do with them, and they don't feel they can trust you, and the pain is so great that unless you're willing to make the commitment to follow through, they don't want contact with you. You have to make some decisions, and you have to make some changes, and you have to show some consistency, and you have to seek for forgiveness. And now make a commitment to love your children by giving them your time, your attention, and yourself. And by giving them their identity, which is what fathers are all about. That is what we are all about. And I call on every father in this room this morning, no matter how old you are, no matter how old your children are, to say to your children today, to every one of your children today, I love you. You may never have done it. It may be the toughest thing you'll ever do to say to your adult son or your adult daughter, I love you. I want to tell you, that is what that child, I don't care if you're 95 and the child is 73, that child has been living all his or her life to hear you say that. And I plead with you to make this the greatest Father's Day you've ever had in your life by simply saying, I love you. And fathers, do not provoke your children, but bring them up in the discipline and the instruction of the Lord. Father, sustain us today and help us, especially as fathers, to follow through with this commitment. For your glory and in your name, amen.